Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Welcome, everybody. Welcome, one and all. Even the cops and the NSA and FBI and CIA and Mossad agents that are listening, welcome to you guys as well. Because I'm sure that you enjoy your jobs, you know, killing, murdering, raping, pillaging, running drugs and injecting heroin and LSD into people's eye sockets in order to discredit them when they get in front of political speeches and what have you. So I hope you'll enjoy this show too, because we also have a very sick sense of humor. My very special guest today is William Ramsey. William, welcome to the program.
Great, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about who it is you are and what it is you do.
Well, basically, I am a 9/11 researcher. I was interested in 9/11 since around 2004 when I realized that it was an inside job. And so I pretty much read everything I could, and I recognized probably within a year or two that there were some deeper occult meanings hidden within the event that were not really disclosed, certainly not disclosed by the mainstream media, and didn't seem to be emphasized by other researchers. So it led me to really do a lot of reading, and I put a book together called Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order, which my general thesis is that his ideas and kind of his own self-made religion influenced the events of 9/11.
And in what way?
Well, it's a good question. Essentially, to figure out how that influenced the event is really it's important to recognize who he was as a person. He was an elitist. He attended Cambridge in England. He was born in 1875 and died in 1947. But he had an elitist sensibility, but he was also involved in magic of kind of the blackest stripe. And that led him to a lot of magical fraternities, namely the Golden Dawn, which was a late 19th century magical fraternity in England, and also the OTO and his own. He developed his own magical fraternity, the AA. And he had a very, he believed that his ideas should be instituted in a political sensibility. He believed that the best political system was actually the feudal system based upon patriarchy. So he had a very male-centric feudal, and I think that you can see this kind of push towards feudalism, at least since 9/11, certainly, but maybe over the last 30 or 40 years with all these types of international banking regulations, NAFTA, etc. But anyway, so he emphasized certain numbers. Essentially, one of his more important numbers was the number 11. It goes back to a book written by one of the founders of the Golden Dawn, William Wynne Westcott. It's called numbers their mystical value, and 11 was seen as this kind of number that emphasized death and destruction. And what led me to understand that these number that the events of 9/11 had these numbers included in them. There were 11, 77, 93, and 175, and I kept seeing them over and over. I didn't really understand their meaning at the time, but after I saw them over and over, I realized that they were there for a reason. They weren't, you know, random, or they weren't there by any type of chance. And essentially 11, you know, was an important number to Crowley, as well as 77. 93 was a very important number in his ideology. He believed in the power of the will, much like Adolf Hitler. And under his Kabbalah, under the Kabbalah, which is kind of an old Jewish mystical text, there was this notion of gematria, where words have a meaning that can be transliterated into numbers. And so the will and basically adds up to 93, and that was the number of the plane. So to make a long story short, those numbers were essentially Kabbalistic numbers that were important to Crowley. And I think that, you know, in my book, it shows that his kind of ideology, at least I make that argument, influenced the September 11 events.
Okay. Well, I like the idea of numerology, and that seems to be used a lot. And you're talking about magic. And a lot of people don't think magic exists, unless they've fallen in love, of course. What I find interesting is that, regardless of whether or not you believe magic exists, the occultists really do believe it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I really didn't know anything about magic. I mean, I found my way into researching magic from 9/11. I really wasn't. I had a very topical kind of deep understanding from maybe cultural figures, rock stars, and things like that. But you're right. These people really do believe it. In the Golden Dawn, there was a William Butler Yeats, who's a famous poetry kind of genius, who was an associate of Crowley. He derived all of his, what he considered his genius, from the practice of magic. And Crowley himself, I mean, even up until his latter days, people would visit him in his 70s, and he was still a believer his whole life in all of these things of magic, the tarot cards, throwing of dice. He believed in astral travel. He believed in all kinds of things. And people who knew Crowley saw these events, and he himself really was trying to break down the kind of doors of perception and to realize and to enter other dimensions. And people who were around Crowley said that he had some form of power, whether it was charismatic or something, but he was definitely...
It sounds like psychopathy to me. Psychopaths are incredibly enchanting individuals who are capable of manipulating other people by reading them and then doing basically whatever it is that you're looking for. A psychopath figures out what it is that makes you tick and then exploits it so that they can use you.
Well, I think that was a pattern in Crowley's life. He was blessed with quite a bit of money that he received from his father when his father passed away, and he abused that. But yeah, he used that up by the time he was about 35, 37. And for the rest of his life, all he did is essentially try to find people to sponge off and use. And he had a long line of people that he basically used up and cast aside. He was always looking for money. He had women who he used for his magical experiments that essentially he would leave as fast as he could. Some killed themselves, some became prostitutes, one actually ended up insane in an institution for 30 years. So he had a long history of psychopathy.
Well, in that case, it's absolutely no wonder that he wanted to get into the occult. I mean, is there a connection there between having no conscience and wanting to have almost unlimited power? I think that's kind of what gets people, like deep occultists like Crowley. They crave power for some reason, and it's almost like psychopathy means that you don't have any self-value, you don't have any self-worth to a degree, because you don't know what emotions are, you can't feel them. All that life is about, it looks to me, from my research, is that basically everybody else is your tools and you're the builder. You don't have any emotional attachment to any of these tools, and you don't actually have any emotional attachment to the thing that you're building. But at the same time, you wouldn't be doing it. You wouldn't be lacing up your tools. You wouldn't be starting to build that house or whatever unless it was worth your while. My question is, what did he want, really? What was Crowley really, really wanting to accomplish with all this occult research, magic, and what have you?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I think what he really wanted was Godhead. He considered himself a prophet, kind of like an Old Testament prophet. He really believed that he was a prophet of a new age and of a new religion. He went back to Egyptology and claimed that he was a prophet of the age of Horus, the hawk-headed god of old Egyptology, and that the era of Osiris was over, which was the old age. And he developed this kind of notion that he was a prophet for hidden masters, which were these spiritual beings that other magicians had a relationship to, such as Blavatsky, or his particular hero was this person by the name of MacGregor Mathers. MacGregor Mathers was the primary magician of the Golden Dawn. But I think that to answer your question, you know, essentially what people like him really want is the primacy of the will and the primacy of themselves as the center of really the universe. I mean, they believe that they...
So is it that classic...
Selfish, sorry.
So basically it's that classic detaching yourself from the human condition via psychopathy and then wanting to take it to its next logical conclusion, which is godhood.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he thought of himself as a god. He encouraged other people to think of themselves as gods. And, you know, he had a contempt for other people. I mean, he said that, you know, he wrote a 927-page magnum opus autobiography called Confessions. And he said on the intro, he said, "I have no motive for deception because I don't give a damn for the whole human race. You're nothing but a pack of cards." So, you know, he had that mentality of he was different. He also was an elitist. It's very important to see him and as a similar figure to other people, the elites that run the world today, is that he grew up at the very apex of the British Empire when Britain, you know, the sun never shone, set on the British Empire. And he had that mentality of ruling over, you know, that was shared by the British Empire, ruling over everybody. And you can kind of see that played out right now in this kind of new world order, which is essentially kind of an old world order, you know, reborn.
Well, is that what happens? Basically, I find that when our ideas get old enough, people forget about them. And then when they return, they think those ideas are new. They think they're revolutionary, that kind of thing. Was this guy trying to bring back something from ancient Egypt or something like that into the modern day or something of that nature?
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. I mean, I think that just like the New World Order, people are surprised what this is happening when it's happened in different eras. You know, Hitler had his own idea of a New World Order, and the British Empire had its own idea, and Crowley definitely had his own idea. And he tried to bring these ideas back from... you know, his kind of religion was based upon things in the past, whether it was the Golden Dawn was a hodgepodge of all kinds of ideas, whether it was the Rosicrucians, Egyptian and Greek mythology, magic. They were really kind of updating, and then Crowley took that and upgraded it himself with his own writings, and so I think that he was definitely going back into the past. He was an admirer of the Hellfire Club, which was a late 18th century club, which was very influential in the running of the British Empire of that time. And many of the central figures that the American colonies went to war against were members of this Hellfire Club. Crowley made his own kind of Hellfire Club in Cefalù, Sicily, in 1920 that you know, he essentially led to him being expelled from Italy. But, yeah, so he used the past and he put it into his own kind of mold, and he said that he was writing for 100 years in the future. He was essentially a literateur. I mean, he was a writer, but he spent tons. He had secretaries and writers writing for him all the time. He had correspondence with many known figures. I emphasize in my book his relationship to people such as Somerset Maugham, H.L. Mencken.
What kind of access did he have? Like, access is power, right? And at the moment, I'm recalling some of Freighter X was telling me that he went into all these different occult orders and went down into their libraries with old tomes that hadn't been looked at in 100 years and things like that. And he's found out a lot of incredible information that nobody else really even bothered to look for. Was Crowley kind of like that? Somebody who had access to big libraries that normal people would never even bother going to, let alone want to?
Well, I go back to Mathers. Mathers was kind of like this organizer for the Golden Dawn. He had actually pulled out old tombs that had not been looked at for a long time. One was called the Goetia, which is a kind of magical record of the 72 demons that King Solomon, David's son, was in contact with. And these came out of the British Museum. There was also something called Abramelin the Major. It was a magical book that Crowley decided to partake in. It was a magical working that he reserved his. He bought a house up in Loch Ness. It was called Boleskin House that Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin eventually owned. But so they were pulling up kind of old things and dusting off old ideas and repackaging them and popularizing them again.
Okay. Well, it seems like the whole Dominion of Earth, he wants to bring it back. The question is, what was in control of the planet at the time that he's trying to reinvent and bring back?
Well,
he wants a new world order, but it's not his idea. He got the idea from somewhere else, and he's trying to fulfill a rebirth of that old order. What was that old order that had rule over the planet so long ago?
Well, I think that for him, he wanted a new order of magic. I mean, I think that that's what he was looking for. His idea was he had kind of given up on. He had grown up in an old Christian, essentially a Christian sect called the Plymouth Brethren, which he found to be very stultifying. And so for him, he was going to, rebirth this kind of occult world. And for him, he said, "The forces of good were those that constantly oppressed me. I saw them daily destroying the happiness of my fellow men. Since therefore was my business to explore the spiritual world, my first step must be to get into personal communication with the devil."
Whoa. Okay, well, let's talk about personal communication with the devil after the break. A very special guest, William Ramsey, Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order is the topic of discussion. We'll be right back, folks. Said the devil to his prison master. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. And we had two questions in the chat room, which can be answered. One was, what is the significance to Aleister Crowley and his followers with the number 9? And the second question was, is Barbara Bush, the wife slash mistress slash demon spawn producing wife of Poppy Bush, H.W. Drug dealing Bush, was she an illegitimate child of Aleister Crowley?
Well, the answer to the first question, number 9, there was a place in London at number 9 Mansfield Street where followers of Crowley would meet. Crowley kept all of his literature there. One of the primary followers of Crowley at that time in the late 20s and early 30s was a gentleman by the name of Gerald York, and he was a scion of a very wealthy British family. Crowley usually drew his followers from the educated and landed classes of Britain. People who graduated from Oxford or Cambridge, like Crowley had graduated from Cambridge. And
they were religious like him, in other words.
Correct. I mean, his view, he had a very elitist view of you know, what to do and how to obtain followers. He really did not, he was not a populist. He did not have a populist sensibility at all. He believed that, you know, people should be, his idea was to kind of, he would say, you want to polish the diamonds and ignore the muck of the mind as kind of a generalization of his yeah, position. But as far as the number nine, you know, that was it was a location in England. Whether that had something to do with kind of the Beatles, he definitely influenced the Beatles. He was on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and he was on there at John Lennon's. It was really John Lennon's idea, and you know, apparently there's been talk that Sgt. Pepper was actually Aleister Crowley. In the intro to Sgt. Pepper's, he says it's 20 years ago today. Sgt. Pepper taught the band to play, and that was 20 years from the date that Crowley died in 1947. So, as far as the number nine, you know, there are definitely some interest. Crowley was into numbers. He believed that everything could be defined by, you know, the universe was defined by numbers. And so when he drew up his magical system, he would refer to everything as like number nine, number 11. And so he had certain rituals that were attached to each one of those numbers. He said, the fundamentals of mathematics are the basis of the Kabbalah. It is natural and proper to represent the cosmos or any part of it or any operation of it or the operation of any part of it by symbols of pure mathematics. So, you know, 9, 11, and any addition of 11 was very important to Crowley. So you had his child sacrifice was book 66, which, you know, most of his followers would never let the public know about. But if you look up book 66, and then he had a book 77, which he called Liber Oz. Oz to him and his system was commensurate to 77. And then Liber Oz was basically what he thought the rot was the rights of man. You know, he believed the law of the strong. This is our Lord, the law of the world. And at the end of book 77, he says, you know, you can do whatever you want, essentially, that was commensurate with his idea, which is do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. That's 11 words, 11 syllables. So he believed in that. And at the end of Liber 77, he said, man has the right to kill those who would thwart these rights. So book 66 and book 77 are, you know, if you want to get into really what the heart of this person was like, it'd be worth reading. Anyway, so that's a long analysis of the number nine.
I asked you a question. I was kind of joking, but almost not. With numbers and everything like that, it strikes me as something chemical. Like there's numbers for all the elements on the periodic table. There's numbers involved with the structure of all kind of cells, and basically numbers are everything. Everything's built on math upon math upon math upon math. So understanding the power of numbers and things like that, I can understand. The question I have though is, do other people actually appreciate it? Is there some kind of transmutational process with the use of numbers or chemical or alchemy or something of that nature, like love potion number nine or whatever?
I don't know. I mean, I know that they like people like Crowley and magicians really are into numerology. The Kabbalah is heavily much, you know, is very numerologically based, and you know, that's something that most magicians really go back to is the Kabbalah. They just love it. And so, you know, I think that he is right. I mean, you know, there are truths within even his vast opus and his what he believed in. I do believe that numbers can't explain a lot of the world. I mean, you're right. I think that it's just it's something that's been excised from maybe Western ideals or people who don't appreciate
it. I think more it's just turned into the opposite. Like that's one of the main tenets of Satanism is to be able to hide or create things by taking what exists and turning it on its head, making it opposite, like six becomes nine or whatever, something like that. They believe that in doing things the opposite way round, that they channel, instead of the positive energy of things being the right way around, that they channel the negative energy, things of that nature.
No, that's a good point. So, you know, I think that, you know, duality is a very important concept in general magic. And, there are notions of the macrocosm and the microcosm, the pentagram and the hexagram. The pentagram represents the microcosm, and the hexagram is the macrocosm. You add those two together, you get 11, by the way. But, you know, even in Crowley's system, the number 11 wasn't just a number. It was an ideogram. It represented duality. It represented two opposing forces. So, you know, that's kind of like when you see that number 11 or even the Twin Towers, that's kind of the occult meaning of the Twin Towers. It's a giant 11.
Well, that's true, because in Freemasonry, there are these two pillars that were outside Solomon's temple called Jachin and Boaz. And essentially, they were a gateway that you had to pass through. You had to basically incorporate both the positive and the negative in order to exercise any form of control and be able to enter the temple. This is also the reason behind Freemasons having black and white Masonic floors. It's the white and the black and the dark and the light, and they believe that they control both. And that's part of the duality, and it's a very, very deep principle within a lot of occult circles.
Yeah, well said. And it's also, the black and white is, you know, we walk over good and evil too, you know, so that are above it. Which is, you know, basically kind of a, you know, my power is above right and wrong. It's maybe goes back to Nietzsche even before that. But anyway, you know,
Barbara Bush.
I'm sorry, Barbara Bush. Let me just say one more thing. Numbers are Occult Power, Mystic Virtue by William Wynne Westcott. It's probably worthwhile taking a look at if you want to just see where you know these guys drew their ideas on and where Westcott got his ideas. Anyway, so Barbara Bush, the story about the rumor about Barbara Bush is that she is the illegitimate offspring of Aleister Crowley from a magical ritual that took place in France in the mid-20s, 1924, 1925.
Okay, so how old is Barbara now?
Oh, good question. Well, she's got to be in her 70s. I know her husband is 87. She's probably in her 80s.
So she was definitely like at maturity by the time Crowley died.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that her and her husband, George Bush, got married right after the war, so it was 46, 47.
Now, George Bush at the time was a tire salesman, and Barbara's family, I forget what her original maiden name was or anything of that nature, but Barbara's family was heavily into banking. No, it was Prescott Bush that I'm thinking of, actually, George H.W. Bush's father.
Right.
Mm. He was the tire salesman, and then when he married whoever it was that he married, she was into big banking circles and whatever, and he wound up the head of a major bank in New York that laundered Nazi gold and sent all the resources away to Nazi Germany, like 30% of their explosives and like 20% of their pig iron plate and such like that. It basically played a huge role in trading with the enemy. And then his child, George H.W. Bush, is off fighting World War II and basically comes back, becomes president, his son becomes president, and you start to wonder, you know, all the blood is mixed together. That it can't be coincidence that all these people wind up in positions of power after being born to parents who are in positions of power. It can't be coincidence.
Agreed. And these, you know, the elitists and people like that, they have a different kind of regimen where they get married and their relationships with others. The marriage between George H.W. Bush and Barbara Bush has all the whiffs of an arranged marriage. I mean, they had met very early. She was 16. He was 18. His father was on the board of essentially Planned Parenthood of that time. Prescott Bush was an associate of Margaret Sanger. So they, you know, believe in the best breed.
She was the founder of Planned Parenthood, or was it the American Eugenics Society it was originally called?
I think it's originally called that, yeah, but it became Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, he was on the board. So I have evidence that shows that, and that was in Kitty Kelly's book about the Bush family. But to go back to Barbara Bush, essentially what Crowley was up to was he had developed his magical rituals from the Golden Dawn, but he went down a far darker path than some of the older Golden Dawn people, whereby he started experimenting with drugs and then moved into sexual magic. And so he really pushed the limits on that. He had, this was when he had been kicked out of Italy in 1924. One of the editors of Vanity Fair, the same magazine that's around today, was a person by the name of Frank Harris. And, you know, it's important to remember that time. It's like this is the Roaring Twenties, but this is also the Belle Epoque. This is kind of the golden age of the Parisian cultural scene, where artists and writers were all going there. Rodin, Hemingway, all these people were there in this era, and Crowley was attracted to that. He was always involved in Bohemia. He had those that sensibility to be around those types of people. Anyway, so Barbara Bush's mother was by a person by the name of Pauline Robinson, and she apparently, the story is that she had a little bit of a wild streak, and she wanted to be part of that scene too. And she had a meeting with Frank Harris's girlfriend at the time, who was somebody by the name of Nellie O'Hara. Well, Crowley's Sex Magical Prize is laid out in D'Arte Magica, D-E-A-R-T-E Magica. His idea was something called, it's essentially a form. I'm trying to put this in a polite manner. He would have servitors who would help him in his ritual that would put him into a kind of a coma state. And it's rumored that she was part of it. I could never find evidence of it, but there's no doubt that Crowley, Harris, and O'Hara were together in Paris at that time in 1924. Whether Robinson was there or not, I couldn't find evidence of it, but the story is that she became pregnant with Crowley. And Crowley, the reality is Crowley had like four kids that were known that made it to adulthood that he really didn't care much about. So he was not averse to having children out of wedlock or just being a kind of a father to whoever wanted it. He had somebody come up to him late in life and who was 19 when he was like in his 67 and said, "I want you to have my baby." And he said, "Okay." So he had a son called Ataturk Crowley, who was about seven by the time Crowley died. But, you know, so Crowley had tons of kids. So it's not outside. This wasn't somebody who would have shied away from that. But that's the rumor, and it hasn't been confirmed. But essentially, there are other tie-ins to Crowley and to Crowley's system, a magical system in the Bush family. That tie-in is that, I mean, she's a hardballer. Barbara Bush is as known as a notorious, cruel person. She had actually said something on Larry King, which is, you know, a big talk show host. I don't know if you guys get him down there, but
I know Larry King. In fact, I model this show slightly on the Larry King show because, okay. Like Larry King, I don't do any research on my guests before I interview them.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, she had said something to Larry King. She was on his show. I think it was in October 03, and to make a long story short, she said, "You can criticize me, but don't criticize my children, and don't criticize my daughters-in-law, and don't criticize my husband, or you're dead." So she had said that on
holy.
Yeah, she said that on TV, and there's records of it out there. So she's a tough anyway. So the tie-in to the Bush family is, like I said,
That's actually another element of psychopathy as well. They don't actually care about anybody and they don't really have any emotions. But if you mess with their family in any way, shape, or form, you heaven help you.
Oh, yeah.
That's basically the modus operandi. Have you noticed that what happens is basically you have two psychopaths for parents. They produce psychopathic offspring and they always wind up being incredibly successful. Because they learn from their psychopathic successful parents how to manipulate others and how to get away with everything and all their crimes and everything. I mean, this is how your presidents are literally made and selected. Do they come from the bloodline? Oh, yes, they do. Do they have any emotions or any conscience or anything like that? Well, no, they don't. Okay, well, we'll have to make them El Presidente then, because after all, you'd never be able to lie to people without people knowing you're lying to them unless you're a psycho with no emotions or giving a flying frack about anybody else but yourself. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Out the door, just in time. Head down the 405. Gotta meet
meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my own. Superman. I'm no Superman.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. You listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. I'm no Superman because I'm not Aleister Crowley and think I'm a god. Okay, my very special guest is William Ramsey, and we were talking about Barbara Bush over the break as well, and it's actually, when you look at the situations, like, let's say, for instance, just my situation. Now, I'm a really creative and hardworking guy, but I actually don't really have much foundation or independence, okay? In fact, part of my, basic life is that the women in my life have always been my rock, and I've tried to be theirs, and you have those a very reciprocal relationship, and it makes you stronger together. I'll be the creative one who goes out and does all this stuff, but if I did not have somebody behind me, I would only be able to accomplish, well, basically half as much, I think. And that's not entirely dissimilar from the relationships between men and women in psychopathic relationships, like, let's say, Poppy Bush and Barbara Bush. She seemed to be the rock that was behind Poppy the whole time, and he seemed to be the one going out and being in the public eye and doing all this big business and what have you. But without her, he'd be nothing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think that you know, they've been together for a long time, and I think their relationship was, you know, it's really, really something unusual in the whole history of the United States when you consider how much George Bush has really been involved in. I mean, he arguably has been running the United States since 1980. I mean, he's been involved in almost everything, running Reagan, his own presidency, his, Clinton was essentially his. He handled Clinton as a CIA agent when Clinton was in England. And, then his son. So, you know, this is a guy who really should be studied. He's kind of like an American Caesar. And he's been involved in so many things over the last 30, 40 years, whether it's financial issues and wars, assassinations. I mean, it's really incredible.
Okay. So, let's talk about something that you might not want to talk about then. You know, now we all self-censor a little bit. There's certain parts of these things that we do, these things that we know that we don't want to sort of talk about for one reason or another, because we think we might be judged for it, or people might think we're crazy for even saying it or even approaching the subject. So if you have anything along those lines, just keep it on the back burner for a second, and if anything springs to mind, here's the place to say it.
My essential view is that Crowley was influenced these people, and I think that they tagged him by having those numbers 1177 93, and even the, I mean, essentially the Bush people are associated and affiliated with the Rockefellers, and I think that the Rockefellers were the ones who built those two buildings. And 9/11 was clearly, to me, an inside job, but it also had those occult markers and elements to it. And it was very ambitious as well. I mean, they really wanted to create kind of a new world system using the bogus excuse of terrorism to create an entirely new kind of global order. And also false flag terror, which was another part. I mean, a lot of the false flag terror that happened all around the world was also structured by the intelligence agencies, whether it happened in Indonesia, or the 77. I mean, the interesting thing is there's 77 again, which is an important number. When you see Flight 77 that happened in 9/11 or 7/7 bombings in London, those were totally fake as well. But they had occult markers. You know, there's a part of my book where I go into where, you know, these Illuminists, you know, the Illuminati still kind of exists as far as, you know, not in the same structure as Weishaupt put together, but the same ideology and, you know, people picking up that torch, so to speak, and walking with it. Still, Crowley himself, he called himself the Esdras of the Illuminati. Esdras is a seldom used word, but what it meant is the defender of the Illuminati. He stated he was very vindictive and nasty, and he was also an intelligence agent, but now it's kind of a tangent. We can talk about that too. But, you know, essentially, there is the secret, and, you know, this is just one element of the secrecy of these people. They're into a doctrine of silence, but, you know, my book just focused on kind of a religious occult that's non-Christian and its influence on the events of 9/11.
Okay. Well, I understand that there's a lot of people that are in very influential positions today who draw on Crowley's works and things of that nature in order to use what he figured out in order to advance themselves in this day and age. What I want to know is, what do people actually have to gain from Crowley's quote-unquote wisdom?
Well, I think the standard things that people want, which is money, power, intellectual power, and the force that he provides, the notion of unleashing your full potential. But for Crowley, it was always selfish. You know, the magician's essentially at the center of the universe. His definition is the definition of magic is the art and science of creating change within the world in conformance with your own will. And, you know, so I think it would be the standard individual human will, you know, desires of individuals is what would be attractive to followers of Crowley. And it's also his idea of freedom. He had a kind of a perverse idea of personal freedom, whereby, you know, doing what you will is totally free and you can do whatever you want and you don't have to worry about other people or what you do or your effects upon the world. So it's very selfish, and, you know, people who are greedy or, you know, are looking for the satisfaction of, you know, their desires find something interesting in Crowley.
Is that, I'm not sure what to say here, because I'm trying to figure out exactly how, okay, they can use it. I mean, we know about the whole idea of illumination, okay, which is to unlock your potential, discard your own doubts about yourself, and instill basically this sense of godlike elitism, right? That's basically what I've seen occult circles preaching and practicing, is that other people are of less value than me, and ergo I am more powerful, and then it gives them confidence, supreme confidence, to go out and do whatever they want, regardless of the consequence. And as a direct result, a lot of these people become high-level criminals, basically.
Right.
Right, that's the criminal code, is it not?
Yeah, and I think Crowley's code is an elite code. I think that Satanism in general is an elite code. Crowley believed, you know, in his Liber 77, that the slave shall serve. I mean, he repeated that often, is that he had this, you know, this notion that, you know, we're gods and we're elitists and everybody else is there to serve us. He said incredible things about... you know, what other people should do. He really thought that there was a wolf and sheep kind of mentality out there. I mean, I can read you this. He said, and this is his commentary. His primary book was the Book of the Law, which he supposedly received from this being called Awas in 1904 in Egypt. He also had this stele that he saw at the Bulaq Museum, which is now the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. It was stele 666 that he adopted. It is his... kind of mantelpiece for his rituals which he called the Gnostic Mass. I mean, he had a variety of different rituals. One of the main rituals is also Ritual 175, which is which God you adore. You see Flight 175 in the event of 9/11. But he said about other people, about ignorant masses, he said, we should not insist on trying to train sheep to hunt foxes or lecture on history. We look after their physical well-being and enjoy their wool and mutton. In this way, we shall have a contented class of slaves who accept the conditions of existence as they really are and enjoy life with the quiet wisdom of the cattle. So he essentially believed in kind of herding, humanity. And, it's kind of like that kind of H.G. Wells story about, the Morlocks and the Eloi, where they were farming humanity. Curly kind of had that mentality, and Hitler kind of adopted that mentality as well. If you take an overlap of Curly's ideology and Hitler's ideology, they're...
But didn't they belong to like some of the same clubs or societies or something? What was the Vril Society, was it?
Yeah, the Thule Society, Thule Gesellschaft.
We'll talk about this after the break. And speaking of numbers and occult symbolism and everything like that, ladies and gentlemen, I now want to start taking callers. So the magic numbers is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. I'm not sure if there's any occult wisdom or things trapped away in that combination of numbers there. Who knows? You may be possessed by a devil if you wind up calling into this show. In fact, you definitely will. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and we'll be back with hour number two in just a few minutes. 218-339-8525.
Delete the virus, alert the masses.
Radio, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated and Fukushima irradiated island chained nation of New Zealand, where everybody by government mandate has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb with mercury. And my very special guest is William Ramsey, talking about the Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order. And we were talking over the break about how I'm not sure. In fact, you should probably tell people what we're talking about over a break, because as an American, you can say it. It's kind of like a black person can talk about black issues, but a white person can't. Otherwise, he gets demonized or whatever. There's a similar situation with this one here.
Lately, I would say Americans don't get a lot of perspective. They only speak one language if they speak that one language well at all. I mean, in Texas, they speak less than one language. There's no doubt about that. But Americans have a very myopic view of the world and other people and cultures that, you know, it'd be worthwhile for them to get out and travel and take a look, go to some other country and take a look back at how other people perceive the United States, its foreign policy. And, you know, the sad reality is that Americans really don't have a say at all in the foreign policy of the country. you know, it's an unfortunate. I think that Americans have no idea how other people perceive them as well in other countries. You know, they're kind of like perceived as the kind of big ornery drunken oaf of the world, which is, you know, unfortunately, it's somewhat true.
Yeah, yeah, being from New Zealand and seeing what other new, have you noticed that how people, if they're talking about somebody else, they very rarely talk about it when that person's around, kind of thing. And I think that's why Americans don't know how the rest of the world thinks, because we're all talking about them behind their back, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in this country, at least, and I've talked to people from many countries, and it seems to be the same general theme, is that Americans are seen as basically suckers. You know, you can sell anything to them, you can tell anything to them, and not only will they buy it and believe it, but they'll go and they'll tell other people to buy it and believe it as well, without so much as a single question being asked. It's almost like dogs that are being led by a choke chain, and unbeknownst to them, they're wearing a collar, and they never even knew it was there. And this type of recognition of just how other people see you, okay, any of the Americans who are listening to this show, that's how a lot of people around the world think of you. Okay, you're a cool, decent, kind-hearted individual who's very generous, aren't you, in general? That's my perspective, because I've actually spoken to Americans, okay? And that's how they all are on the whole. However, it's overlapped by almost this air of gullibility to a degree, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that, I mean, look at all the lies that we've been told, at least as Americans, for decades, and it seems like there's really hasn't been too much pushback by the average person. I think they're starting to wake up, but you know, there was a time that, you know, back in the day, like de Tocqueville was the French kind of noble who traveled around the United States in the early 19th century. He said that the country back then had the smartest, most educated, well informed people, and we've come a long, long way from that. And I think it's due to, you know, drugs, fluoridization, bad media,
As a result, it's funny because we're talking about Americans, right? And we've got somebody in the chat room who's saying, but New Zealanders are exactly the same. And this is another interesting point as well, is that in every country, we look at every other country as being the problem, and we don't see ourselves as the morons who need to be helped out of this situation, do we?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's easy to judge somebody else other than yourself. I mean, I it's just, it's rough. I mean, I see, you know, I just see like a lot of zombies, and I that zombie meme. I talked to another guy on a show a couple weeks ago. It's like, I think that zombie meme has a lot of import because there's so many zombies out there, you know. I think that people have been dumbed down, they've been drugged out. You know, so many people in the United States are on antidepressants, which basically puts you into like a fugue state or some kind of zombie state. We've had like zombie, I don't know if you've been following, but we've had like literal...
The bath salt, yeah.
What's that?
The bath salt incident.
Yeah, the bath salters. We've had literal zombie events here in the last 2, 3, 4 weeks. I mean...
Only in America! Oh, it's so rough.
So anyway, I mean, it is interesting how people, and it's, I think that's important of travel. I mean, I think that it really does give you a good idea of,
oh my god, another great comment on the chat room. Our morons are better than your morons. USA USA. Oh my god, it's so true, it's so true. Oh my god, we're all retarded. Oh Oh, God. Hey, in fact, speaking of morons, I was watching the breakfast program this morning on the New Zealand TV, right? And he had a list of the top 15 television programming and stuff like that for every country. And why, Shiite Muslim you not, the top 15 shows in every single Western nation was either sport, a reality cooking show, or like The Voice or American Idol type variant. Okay, that's the... Or soap operas. Those are the only four things that actually make it into the top 15. Don't you think that that's a sign of how really messed up people's attention is?
Absolutely. I mean, what's really scary, it's like, you know, you try to tell people about some very serious political issues, and you have no idea what you'll get in return. I mean, I've talked to people, literally, who I tell the, like, honest-to-God historical truths to, based upon facts and evidence that are written in encyclopedias, and they either call me a conspiracy theorist, that's their immediate comeback, or they want to get away because they just are so far out of their comfort zone and having that discussion. It's like they pause and you get this kind of blank stare, and like, I feel uncomfortable too. Like, whoa, I mean, I didn't know I just pushed you out into the intellectual deep end on this, you know, discussion about when the war ended, World War II ended or something, you know, some very topical, very simple stuff. So it's unnerving to walk around them. I mean, you got to watch. I don't know what it's like in New Zealand, but around here, I mean, you got to watch what you say to certain people because they literally
will. It's the same. It's the same thing.
I don't know. I don't watch sports. So people will like come up to me and talk to me, and I'll just be like, I have no idea. And so it's a very odd kind of invasion of the body snatchers kind of moments that happen to me daily. Like, I really don't know. And but if other people find it important, I don't. So anyway, it's a strange.
That's why it's impossible to deny that we live in a new world order already, isn't it? Because I was having a conversation with one of the listeners who's down in Mexico, Rini, and she's getting into her older years now. And she moved away from the United States to go to Mexico to get away from the Americanization, as she called it. And now, living in Mexico, she's seeing it pop up everywhere. And I said to her, it's not Americanization at all. Okay? There's no liberty principle. There's no constitutionality behind it. There's no spirit of liberty or creativity or entrepreneurship or anything with this global system. It's a new world order system. It's new world orderization. And that's it, pure and simple. And the United States is being, they're basically the fall guy, okay? We had this finance company called Hewlett Wealth Management here in New Zealand, and it was headed by three people. Mark Hewlett, or whatever his name is, Don Brash, who's a former Reserve Bank governor, he's like the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke of New Zealand kind of thing, and another guy, John Banks, who is the former mayor of Auckland, the country's largest city, like the equivalent of Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. And this company collapsed, okay? Absolutely collapsed, and everybody lost their money, and Mr. Hewlett went to jail. But these other two scum didn't. They didn't even so much as get investigated, charged, when they were guilty, clearly, with even the most modicum bit of research that some of the activists in New Zealand have done on this topic, clearly guilty of the exact same crimes, and yet they get away with it, okay? It's the whole thing. Criminals come in, they get involved with you, and they get you to trust them, and then they use you as their fall guy. And I think that America is the Hewlett Management fall guy of the world now. They're trying to, the New World Order is trying to get everybody to hate America, to hate Americans. And I think it's because the New World Order really hates America and hates Americans, namely because they've still got guns. They're still slightly freer than a lot of other countries, perhaps. They've still got a constitution that technically exists, although it's not followed in any way, shape, or form. And that kind of thing. They don't want that. So I think there's a deliberate effort through the media, through the history books, and everything, basically, to make America the fall guy. Do you think that might be true?
Yeah, I do. I think that really what they're against is kind of the ideals that built America, which were individualism and kind of entrepreneurship and that kind of pioneer spirit. They really hate that, and that you can go out and do it on your own. I mean, so I think that it's really the ideals that were really the foundation of America, the kind of John Wayneism, without kind of the, you know, kind of provincialism of John Wayne, I guess, but just like a can-do attitude. They really want you to be a slave, in a really simple term. Or they want everybody in the world, and they want to, you know, the Ancien, I guess you could say the Ancien regime or the ancient regime really likes that pyramidal tiered system of the elites on top and the you know, slaves that are there relying on them for food and water. I mean, in the United States, you see the main entrepreneurship that's taking place and the engine of growth that has been in the country for the last 100 years is taking place in California, where you've got like the global film industry and the tech industry in the north, where there wasn't that kind of social striation. It was kind of like a brand new, you know, pioneer mentality where real talent could shine, because in the East Coast, they didn't have that mentality. You know, it's all the kind of governmental system. And
that is the real American spirit, is allowing people's talent to shine. I mean, Danny Romero from American Freedom Radio, I came on as a guest host on a radio show here once, and then he saw my talent and gave me the show. I think that's what Americans do. They like justice. They like seeing people be successful, and they're generally kind-hearted and helpful. That yeah. spirit that makes Americans American is being annihilated. People are distrustful of each other and judgmental and this kind of thing, and it's dividing them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really it. I mean, if you have somebody with an old line, blue blood mentality, there's always that whiff of, you know, they've gotten it easy, I think, from their view, and they really don't like. I've seen people from the East Coast come out to California. I used to work in one of the bigger tech companies. And they have a different mentality, and they're jealous of that can-do mentality. They want to do it their way, and they're happy that they went to Princeton. I know a guy who was from Princeton, and these old East Line, what we call it, you know, the Ivy League company, country, colleges, Ivy League colleges. They really do not like the fact that people can just start up their own company and make billions of dollars, you know. They really just don't like it all.
Like Bill Hicks, coming from New York to LA is really funny. It's like there's no weather in LA. It's just every day hot and sunny. It's like, what are you, a lizard? Okay, I'm a mammal. I can afford scarves and coats, cappuccino, rosy cheek women, and all are available for sale. And this type of thing is quite funny, because you've got people who live technically in the same country, yet they're on different sides of it, and they find the little differences, and they only talk about those differences. They only think about those differences. Whereas if you were to shift your focus and think about what do we have in common, what are our similarities, you'll find more similarities than you can handle.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
How do we turn this around? I mean, knowledge of the occult, I think, is actually an important yet very kind of beat down sort of mentality. And it actually is, I feel, so important for people to come to grips with, because it allows you to figure out how you have been manipulated by the occultists and what have you. Now, we've got a caller on the line here. Caller, you're probably only going to be talking for about 30 seconds before we go to break, so you'll be able to hang on there. But before we go to break, welcome. Caller,
hello?
Yep.
Am I on the air?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, I didn't really want to be on the air.
Okay. Well, conveniently, we're coming to break.
Is this Vinny?
Yeah.
You know, what I have to tell you might not be as important for you as Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. God dang, I do not want to be on the air.
I'll tell you what, just tell us your first name and what state you're calling from, and we'll come back to you. You don't have to be worried about anything. And if you want to say something or whatever, actually just go to the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and you can pop in your questions there or something if you don't really want to ask it on air. All right. So we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break. 218-339-8525.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Hearing, hopefully you're also feeling the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from your calcified pineal gland, injected directly into your bloodstream with the help of a nice preservative known as thimerosal, exposing scumbaggery and giving a platform to the people who would otherwise be sound bitten away into obscurity. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And by the way, I'm a servant, ladies and gentlemen, an absolute servant in the best of it. And you know what's interesting about servants is that they're totally dependent on their masters, aren't they? If you're a servant, you have to make sure that your master feeds you, otherwise you starve to death. I'm a servant of all the listeners to the show, all the people, all the truthers of the world, okay? I have no reservations, okay? There basically is nothing I won't talk about, in terms of subject matter. Sometimes I'll only want to talk about it in private or something of that nature. But basically, it works like this. If you want me to interview somebody, but you're wondering whether or not I'll accept them as an interviewee or something like that, or I might be a bit prejudiced or whatever, that's not the case, okay? Namely, I don't care. It's just like basically somebody sends me a name and an email address, I email that person and ask them to come on the show. That's as simple as it is. I don't know who they are. I don't know what's why the listener has asked me to interview them in a lot of cases. And in many cases, I don't know what they're actually going to talk about. I just do it because you, the listeners, and you, the activists, ask me to either bring somebody you know on air or bring yourselves on air. Okay? There are some people who criticize me and say for giving people platforms to talk about things because they're people that they disagree with. And they say, oh, if you give that person a platform, then you're part of the New World Order automatically by default. So I've been out 4 years and busting my hump and living hand to mouth because I'm a servant of the New World Order, am I? Frickin' retard. Okay. It's the thing. I want to build a media conglomerate, a very, very comprehensive media conglomerate where we will have a central website like guerrillamedia.co.nz is. I definitely need to give it a good redesign because it looks like crap. But the basic idea is this. You have a website. Everybody who wants to contribute can, you know. All you have to do is ask. It's like, Vinny, can I become a contributor to your website? Sure. Here's your authority. Start posting. I'm not going to edit. I'm probably not even going to read it or anything like that. I'm just giving you the ability to post something with zero cost. I'll pay the website hosting fees. So there's one. That's the web. Second medium is radio. You want to come on the show? Cool.
What we're going to do is we're going to broadcast it live on AMFM affiliates, real radio stations. Then we're going to archive it on a number of different websites, and you can also share these on your websites as well. And also, it is archived on YouTube. So just coming on the radio show means that you get on YouTube, you get on a web, you get on a number of different websites, and people can listen to that interview and archive whenever they feel like it. On top of that, there is the real world filming type aspect. So if you are doing a public meeting or if you are doing a protest, a lot of times I will show up, film that public meeting, film that protest. And unlike most people who film public meetings and protest, I upload it so that others who could not make it can at least see what went down. And this is particularly important for public meetings because I will routinely see that the people who attend public meetings are very much a small, determined minority, usually within the 40 to 60 age range, who are perhaps either retired or refuse to work in the conventional sense and are trying to make their own lives as they see fit. However, there are only a few people. And they don't communicate, and they don't with huge amounts of other people in a lot of cases. So when I film it and upload it, the meeting becomes 10 times larger on average. 10 times as many people will watch the video of the meeting than actually turn up. That's the service I provide. If you are doing a presentation, for instance, as Ian, what's his name? Ian R. Crane from the UK did a presentation on Codex Alimentarius when he came here to New Zealand. I was sick at the time, so I wasn't able to go film him, but my good friend and kind of assistant and Mikhail went and filmed it for him, and I edited it. I got his slides and things of that nature and actually uploaded it, okay, and more people saw it than were actually there at the meeting. So it is professional quality that I'm trying to strive for now. So if you do a presentation, if you do a public meeting, if you do anything that the mainstream media won't report on in its entirety, I will be the person that you come to at the end of the day. And that's what I want to have for everybody. At zero cost, at any point, if you have something important to say and you know the mainstream media will ignore you, come and see me. I will put you on the internet in many, many different forms, and I will do it all for you for free. I will edit it all and spend all my own time so that you have the capacity to be out there. And also, more to the point, the reason why I'm doing all that work for you is so you can continue doing your very important work and important research and important protesting and important talking at public meetings. You don't have time for any of this other jargon and junk and technical skills and things of that nature. And I say, why should you? Somebody else should come and support you. You've spent your entire life sweating and bleeding and working to try and save humanity in your own particular field of research. And I think it's only fair that out of your service to humanity, that somebody like me come up and basically put their best foot forward to support you. And as a direct result of this, people are coming out of the woodwork to support me just in the important work that I do. And so if you want to help me, I need your help too. I'm utterly dependent on the listeners. I'm utterly dependent on donations, subscriptions, purchases of the website. If that stops, I'm dead in the water. I can't pay my rent. I can't pay my food. Everything that I'm wearing most times and all the equipment that I'm using most times is either bought with donations or donated the equipment themselves. Everything. And I'm not kidding. So if you want to make sure that something happens with your money or happens with that camera that you don't use, send it to me. And you can be resting assured that I will make better use of it and support and help more people because I have the time. Simply because I'm doing it full time. I don't have a slave job to go to. And I will never want to go back. I literally can't. I've had a pan. It's something I'm not capable of dealing with. going back into the slave works workforce. It's not going to happen. So please, ladies and gentlemen, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Subscribe for $5 a month. It's a pitiful amount to ensure that the activists, any of them that you like, you can get them invited onto this show. And that's regardless of whether or not you subscribe or not. Everybody should be able to benefit from all of this information that I'm putting out from people for free. And they can. Even the people who subscribe, who I send the commercial-free archives to, anybody can get those commercial-free archives. All you need to do is ask, and I'm there to serve you. Please, please return the favor, because I need your support at all times. Now, we have a caller just called in, and I think it might have been that caller who didn't want to be on air.
All right, Vinny.
Yeah.
Called back.
All right.
I kind of freaked out when I was online. You had a radio show 2 days ago about, like, you got to speak up.
Okay. Well, can I ask you something? Just what's your first name and the state that you're in?
Yeah, just my first name. Larry.
Larry? Yeah.
And, you know, this is something I don't know if you know much about, but I live in, like, in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know much about, like, supposedly a meeting, Stu Webb? Do you know Stu Webb?
I do.
Have you
do
ever heard of him?
Yeah. In fact, I got an email from him this morning. I haven't opened it yet.
All right. Anyway, I live in Colorado. Okay. And I listen to you, and I know you're kind of, and it's kind of freaked me. I thought I got it on the radio, and I just said, well, you had a radio thing a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
People need to stand up. So anyway, he's talking about the Broadmoor Hotel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And about the Bushes are supposed to show up and Kissinger and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Do you know about that?
Like I said, I haven't opened the email.
Okay, yeah, just, Sunday morning's really big
I'm
on that.
I'm glancing through it now. It says, please pass this on to everyone you can on Occupy Colorado Open Groups, Occupy Denver.
Yeah,
Occupy
they're talking about the Masonic Temple and a thing outside of Castle Pines.
So that means today.
I'm familiar with all this area.
It says Occupy 100 Illuminati Bankers, June 20th.
Yeah. Yes.
So that's at stuweb.com. Anybody who's in the Colorado area. And thank you, Larry, for calling in and switching us on to this, because it's actually a time-sensitive thing, isn't it? Because it's happening today.
I actually was down there.
Stuweb.com. STEWWEBB.com. And it should have something on there. So it's the Occupy 100 Illuminati Bankers, I think.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for that, Larry. And by the way, I like to ask this of all the callers who call in. And it's kind of like, basically, imagine we're just having a cup of coffee in a cafe or something like that, and it's just you and me talking. So what kind of actually woke you up to the New World Order, Larry? What got you interested in it?
I've been doing this like 5 years.
Before?
I've been listening to you for years. I find, you know, Sean David, the American Freedom Radio. I've been on this for about 5 years. This is one thing I could check out myself, you know? Because I know everything about the Broadmoor. I have inside people in the Broadmoor. So I actually went down to the Broadmoor, hung out, talked to a lot of people, hung out for a couple hours, talked to someone who knows everything, who's an insider. And, you know, the Clintons work with them, you know, blah, blah. You know, when they had the Democratic Convention, they all hang out at the Broadmoor. And I have a friend who takes care of everybody.
So did your friend kind of enlighten you as to this thing, and then that's what got you interested and started your own search for the truth, is it?
No. I've been on it a long time ago. It's you guys that got me. I mean, listening to you, all these other, you know, you guys all that pitch stuff out on the line. I don't want to put myself in line, which is I don't want to give you my name. I don't want my phone number. I didn't even want to be on the line. You know, I know too many people. You know, I know people that don't be. Yeah, I've seen the CIA. I'm interrogated every 5 years.
Every 5 years?
People I know have computer, clearances with the war machine. So I get investigated every 5 years. And since Homeland Security, I don't get investigated. They just go into my computers, which I know for a fact, and they go into my phone lines. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, I have friends who work with the military, industrial, blah, blah. So, yeah, no, that's what got me into it long ago. But, like you guys, I don't know, something resonated a couple days ago or three when you were talking about stepping up.
Stepping up and taking some responsibility, right? And I find that we all come to that point in our own way. And I was watching my speech at the David Icke thing when he came to New Zealand last year, and I said to people, when you wake up, when you decide that you're actually going to take a camera, go out there, get in people's face, expose scumbaggery and what have you, the time that you do that, doesn't matter what time it is, it's the perfect time for you. Everybody comes to the truth in their own way, and everybody activates in their own time. That's my belief. I mean, you're either going to or you're not going to.
And that resonated with me. And I have kids, so I have a lot to lose.
We all do. Basically, I think we've come to the point where we know that they're going to take everything, so regardless of what we do. So we may as well do something while we're still here. Larry, thank you so much for your call. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to call in, the final segment coming up, 218-339-8525. 218-339-8525.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winston, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa,
when George Bush's C-130 pilots are taking off from airfields in Afghanistan laden with fresh poppies that their troops that they sent there from poor towns in America have harvested at the behest of the US government in order to save the country from itself and its terrible drug problem that didn't exist before the Americans got there, that's the song that they play. I've been everywhere, man. Harvesting poppies over there, man, and refining some heroin back at home, man, and then distributing it all over the streets, man. Never mind. I think that kind of fell flat. My very special caller is Joe in LA. Joe, welcome to the program, bro. I know you're at work on break at the moment, so go for your life.
I'm on break, Vinny. How you doing today?
Somewhat fabulous is my party line.
Awesome. Hey, just want to share a quick story. This weekend I went to my cousin's wedding party, and I actually met another truther there. I have a cousin who's a big Obama supporter, basically never believes anything I want to say, so we basically had like a little intervention with him. It was pretty funny. But yeah, this guy I met, I'm sorry?
It's cool when you meet other truthers, eh?
Yeah, I was talking about him, and I just brought up that I study global conspiracies, and then he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, you know who Alex Jones is?" And I go, "Yep." And then so that just started a conversation, and my cousin Mariana, her fiance, he's one of those types who doesn't really care. You know, I just worry about, you know, going to work and back every day. And, you know, we worked on him a little bit for about 10 minutes. And then my cousin, he's a big Obama supporter and still under the influence of the mainstream. But, yeah, we sat him down. I just had my friend, my new friend. I go, hey, why don't you tell him what happened to you 2 years ago? And so he basically just told him, you know, 2 years ago he was surfing a Nantsaw video. And it had the website on there. And he clicked on the website, started listening to the show. And then he challenged anybody who was listening, if you don't believe me, just go ahead and Google it. Google this right now. And then he looked it up, and he was like, whoa. And then just kept on looking stuff up to verify, and then he realized that, you know, certain things were going on. His wife thinks he's going a little bit too far with it, and she's scared that, you know, at least this truther guy's wife, that she's scared that it'll come back to hurt him and his family, you know, if he's too vocal. So basically, he told her this is the reason why we have to spread the word, because we want to not be able to, not to have that fear of retaliation from the government for simply speaking truth and opening our mouth.
I also find it quite hilarious that non-truthers will tell truthers to stop talking about the truth because somebody will come and get them. And yet they also tell the truth is that I don't believe anything that you say, and there's no conspiracy, and nobody's out to get you.
Exactly. It was like an oxymoron, and I go, and it's funny, you know, towards the end of the party, I tell my new friend's wife, I go, you know, I gave her a hug, because I knew her from before, and I go, listen to your husband, he knows what he's talking about. And he had tried to talk her out of getting their baby vaccinated. Unfortunately, she was adamant about it, and he kind of capitulated to her. So, and that's an issue that's going to come up with me and my girlfriend. We're celebrating our 2-year anniversary next week, going to Vegas, and, you know, we're not going to get married or nothing, but, you know, we're planning on eventually starting a family. And
well, I don't know if you're not going to get married. It depends how drunk you are.
Yeah, true that. No, but exactly. I told her, because one of the issues that really matter to me the most is, you know, as a father, you know, our job is to protect our children. And I was honest with her, you know, regardless of everything else that I've studied, one of the major issues that I have a problem with is vaccination after, you know, knowing what I know now. And, you know, first thing she told me when I brought up, she was, oh, no, we're vaccinating. And she actually teaches at a daycare, and she teaches 1- and 2-year-olds. And, there's one kid in her class who's non-vaccinated, and I go and I actually met his mom and the kid. I didn't bring it up, but, you know, and I asked her. He's perfectly healthy, isn't he? And she kind of opened up her mind. But I told her, like, if we don't vaccinate the kid and something happens to our baby, you're going to resent me for not having the kid vaccinated. And if we vaccinate the kid and something happens to the kid, like autism or something, then I'm going to resent you, you know? So I told her this is a very important issue that we're going to have to face eventually. So we basically came to the agreement that before we have children, that we're going to research as much as we can, and I'm going to try to share as much as I can about the autism research and the vaccine research. So it was all in all, it was a pretty productive party, and it was pretty cool, meaning, you know, like I was telling the last time I called in the guy that my hope comes from, you know, everybody who's waking up slowly but surely, and just one random day at a party, meet another truther, and like we're instant bros, you know what I mean? And yeah. We're feeding back off each other, so.
Well, I go out partying, basically, I never go out and pay for partying kind of thing. I'm usually filming a gig at a dance party or something of that nature, right? Or going around to a friend's place or for their special birthday party or whatever. And the thing that I find utterly perplexing is that it is impossible for me to not find at least one truther a night. At least one, usually more, okay? We're everywhere, man. And as long as you keep talking the truth and everything like that, all the different people that you're talking to, one of them will resonate. And that one person will be far more valuable than the other 200 people who called you a conspiracy theorist, right? And it'll make you feel a lot more related, too. So, Joe, thank you for your call, man. And if you have anything else to say, just quickly, because we have to final words closing with William Ramsey here. Do you have a question for him or anything?
No, I actually don't. I apologize. I was so prepared. I tuned in a little bit late this afternoon, but I am enjoying the conversation thus far. And I want to thank you again, bro. You guys have a good afternoon.
You're welcome. And don't worry about being ill-prepared. We're truthers. We don't need to be overly prepared. The New World Order needs copious quantities of preparation and dumbing down in order to accomplish even one thing that they want. All we have to do is just think it, then do it. That's why we're going to win, because we don't need to get anybody's permission to do the right thing. Okay, let's talk about your documentary, William.
Well, I did. I made a couple documentaries a couple years ago. They're online. You can see them on Amazon Video on Demand. One is essentially just a visual version of my book, and I go through kind of the same kind of material. It's about 90 minutes. I also did one of Cold Hollywood, which kind of goes into the same influences that Crowley had upon Hollywood, and same numbers, etc. So, you know, it's worthwhile for, you know, people to see that, you know, his influences kind of move through our culture. And I have a section in my new version. The second edition of my book is coming out July 1st, and it deals with kind of the children. Crowley went by the term the Beast. They called him the Beast, and I called this section the Children of the Beast, people who were influenced by his ideas and who had been exposed to Crowley, who had an influence on Western civilization, such as Charles Manson, Kenneth Grant, L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, was a huge Crowley fan. He just loved, he couldn't get enough of Crowley's information. Timothy Leary is a follower of Crowley. He had all of Crowley's information and books. Alfred Kinsey went to the abbey where Crowley was in Cefalù in Italy. He was the famous kind of sexologist. He's been pretty much debunked, but he was very much into Crowley's doctrines. Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. You've got Ozzy Osbourne, Hugh Hefner. Oliver Stone references Crowley quite a few times. So does Stanley Kubrick, Arthur Clarke. Aldous Huxley actually met the guy who did Doors of Perception, wrote Doors of Perception. He kind of built a lot of stuff on Crowley's ideas of experimentation with drugs, etc. He'd actually had dinner in Germany, Weimar Germany, with Crowley, and Crowley painted his portrait. J.K. Rowling, Roman Polanski, Michael Jackson. He had something on his shoulder, 777, which was Crowley's book on correspondences. So these guys have tagged themselves as at least being influenced, not maybe being hardcore followers. But, you know, and Crowley's have influenced kind of hip-hop, rap. Jay-Z had a shirt called Do What Thou Wilt on it. So I kind of go into that information. And, you know, so I'm still kind of working on a lot of these kind of connections between Crowley and other people that a lot of people aren't too familiar with.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I suggest you go and research that documentary if it is of interest to you. And William, thank you so much for coming on with us today and spending a couple of hours of your valuable time. I've actually learned a little bit more about Aleister Crowley that I didn't know. So as far as I'm concerned, it was really, really worth it. And I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be on the show.
All right. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And after the show today, we'll be doing a call-in with the listeners. So if you want to join us in the chat room at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com and pop your Skype name in there, we will add you to the call. And we will have a nice, friendly, happy discussion with truthers and what have you after the show, as we do every day from now on. So cool. See you there, ladies and gentlemen. We'll